Okay, welcome to From City to the World. I'm your host, Vince Boudreau, the president of the City College of New York. From City to the World is a show about how the work that we're doing at City College matters to people across the city and throughout the world. So we'll be discussing the practical application of our research in solving real-world problems like poverty and homelessness and mental health challenges. And today we've got a really exciting show where we'll be talking about women and science and some of the science more specifically. So it is Women's History Month, and as we recognize the incredible contributions of women throughout history this month, today we're going to continue that recognition by discussing the transformative opportunities in the sciences led by women in the field, both in general, out in the world, and here at City College. So the Phase 2 Crest Center for Interface Design and Engineered Assembly of Low-Dimensional Systems, I'm going to say that again, the Phase 2 Crest, that C-R-E-S-T, Center for Interface Design and Engineered Assembly of Low-Dimensional Systems. I'm going to take a shot and say low-dimensional systems means super thin materials. That's IDEALS at CCNY. It's a National Science Foundation-funded program, and it aims to enhance the research capabilities of minority-serving institutions and effectively integrate education and research. So here at City College, the research activity of IDEALS is rooted both in integrating the research on these low-dimensional systems into a range of programs intended to transform the experience of all graduate students and postdocs working in this field by developing in them leadership skills, helping them obtain a global perspective, and advance skills for success in academic and industrial workplace environments. So throughout students' experience, they receive practical training in material science, device fabrication and characterization at the CUNY ASRC. So that's the science part of this, and we'll talk a little bit more about that real soon. But students also gain exposure and formal training in aspects of commercialization, entrepreneurship, intellectual property development, which develops and expands on their professional opportunities. This is really important given the federal investments that are being made in chips and semiconductors and all of these sorts of things. So we want our scientists both to be able to do great science and also to be able to interface with the commercial side of things. So to discuss the National Science Foundation Crest Center IDEALS and its impact on students here at City College, we have Professor Maria Tamargo. She's a professor in the Department of Chemistry here at CCNY. She's the director of the Crest IDEALS Phase 2 program here at CCNY. She began her professional career in 1978 as a member of technical staff at AT&T Bell Labs. In 1984, she moved to Bell Corps before joining the Faculty of Chemistry Department here at the City College of New York in January of 1993. At City College, she established a leading research program of the molecular beam epitaxial growth of semiconductor materials. And I'm pretty sure City College had about the first epitaxy facilities in the city back when you started building those. And so this is a very important technology in producing new kinds of novel materials. She's also pursued novel photonics applications such as visible light emitters, high performance photovoltaics, infrared light emitters, and infrared sensors. Professor Tamargo's research has focused on the synthesis and characterization of semiconductor materials with technological applications. She's currently investigating novel materials known as topological insulators that are being vigorously pursued for advances in technology such as quantum computing. And again, I'm going to take a shot at this one. As I understand it, these are conducting materials where the conduction takes place over the surface of the material rather than through the material. So that allows things to move much more quickly, and we'll get into that a little bit as we talk. She is in the doctoral program in the chemistry, physics, and electrical engineering departments. Over the years, she's also been deeply involved in advancing educational and mentoring programs that strive for more diverse and inclusive participation in the sciences and in the engineering field. She's the author of over 325 research publications in peer-reviewed journals and book chapters, as well as several patents. She served as the Dean of Science at CCNY from 2001 to 2007. She holds a bachelor's degree in chemistry at the University of Puerto Rico, Rico Piedras, and a PhD in chemistry at Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore, Maryland. Professor Tamargo, welcome to From City to the World. We're really glad to have you today.
Thank you, President Woodrow. Happy to be here.
Glad to have you. So let's talk just a little bit. Before we talk about the work of sort of women in STEM, I want to get a little bit of grounding in the work that you do, the science work that you do. So you've had this wonderful career in semiconductor research. And so for researchers who may not be familiar with that, and as a way of correcting my kind of limping explanation of your work, can you explain how your work implicates everyday technology and what it is that you're mainly focused on these days?
Okay, so let me describe what our work is. And you've already said a lot, but let me say it again and then try to go into, you know, how it might impact technology. So over the years, my group has worked on synthesizing semiconductor materials and fabricating structures that combine these materials, multiple layered structures, with the goal of understanding and improving their properties and exploring the real world applications that they may provide, usually through collaborations with physicists and engineers. So we use this technique known as molecular beam epitaxy, or we call it MBE for short, for the synthesis of the materials. And it's a very intricate, sophisticated evaporation technique that allows the depositions of ultra-thin layers of highly ordered crystalline materials and stacks of these highly crystalline ultra-thin layers that have new and unique properties. The ultra-thin property is important. I think you mentioned this because, some people know, semiconductors' properties are affected, are tuned by reducing their size down to the nanoscale. So if we can go down to the nanoscale, we can explore new phenomena. The technique MBE is well suited for research, but it's also used in fabrication, in commercialization entities in industry that are doing these semiconductor materials. So the students that work in our lab get experience in a real world technology. So we design these new materials with novel and unique properties, and we also develop the synthetic process itself to make them better and have optimal properties. Now, over the years, we've worked on different materials and different structures, and some of them have found their way into particular real commercial applications, or they have, if not directly been used, they have impacted the choices that industry has made in the commercial applications. And these include, early on in my work, semiconductor lasers used in light wave communication, lasers and light-emitting diodes in displays, sensors used in health diagnostics, and materials and structures for interesting photovoltaic devices in energy applications. So that's kind of the scope of our work and the connection with the real world.
Could you talk a little bit about this latest phase of the research with
the topological insulators?
That's what I was going to say,
right.
Yes.
So the topological are semiconductors as well, but they're a unique kind of semiconductors, and they're actually the traditional semiconductors in the new lingo are referred to as trivial semiconductors, while topological insulators are exotic semiconductors. Mm. And they have this property where they have properties in the bulk of a semiconductor, but then their surfaces have highly conducting, with other favorable properties, surface states that can conduct electricity unimpeded with very little or no use of energy. So they're very, very attractive for a variety of novel applications like quantum computing. Although that transition between the material and the quantum computing, I'm not quite ready to describe in any kind of detail. It's far away.
Yeah. When you look at a material like this, is the thing you're looking for energy efficiency? Is it the speed of the transmission? Is it something else that makes it really exciting for you?
The speed and the efficiency of the transmission is one aspect of the applications. Mm-hmm. I think the more detailed physics is very important. So understanding some other properties, like electrons have a property known as spin, which is not used traditionally in semiconductor, at least not very much in semiconductor technology. It opens up a whole new field of how to take advantage of these materials in semiconductor devices. So something called spin momentum locking, so that you can control the spin of the electron as well as the transport, electrical transport. So that's just one.
That does sound exotic. let me ask you, if you, some people love to do this, some people hate to do this, but if you can look ahead 10 or 20 years and you think about the trajectory of this technology, what should we be looking for, anticipating?
So yeah, that is a difficult question to answer. Mm-hmm. But so you know, usually sometimes things happen quickly and discoveries happen quickly and they revolutionize the technology fast. But typically what we're working on in the lab now will only really be used 10 or 20 years from now. Mm-hmm. And so the things we're working on now are the ones that we should be looking at for making an impact. In my field, I think there is currently a revolution in materials discovery and design. New materials are being made with new physics that has to be learned and has to be explored. So it's going to take some time to mm-hmm. really fully put it in place. If I were to predict areas of growth, I'm not predicting them myself. Everybody's talking about it, obviously. Mm-hmm. Communications technologies, anything that has to do with transferring information, voice, image, data. So of course, computing. It's basically how we do this is mm-hmm. computing. So the possibility of quantum computers, which we all hear about now, as something. It's a totally new product. It's not just an incremental improvement on computing. It's just something different and much greater, multiplying the capabilities many times. Mm-hmm. So that's one thing, and how that's going to impact the world, it's not so clear mm-hmm. yet, I mm-hmm. think. Maybe some people have. But there are many other things that these materials, including the topological insulators, are interesting for. And, you know, sensing is one possibility that these materials provide that is unique mm-hmm. and improved or significantly enhanced towards from what we do now.
Like medical sensing, or you mean
so
satellites?
Sensing of any kind, which okay. includes health applications, and so, you know, changes in the way we diagnose illnesses or treat healthcare, provide healthcare should be dramatically improved. Atmospheric monitoring, mm-hmm. monitoring the environment so that we can better take care of things in time to resolve and make it more sustainable. Mm-hmm. Also things like robotics and, autonomous vehicles and, you know, there's a lot of things that new semiconductor materials can do to really advance mm-hmm. all these things and then give us all kinds of new gadgets that will make our life different and new and better, hopefully.
That's really exciting. I'd like now to kind of just to pivot a little bit, because it is Women's History Month, and one of the things that ties this program together is the role of women in science. And so tell us just a little bit about your origins as a scientist. What got you interested first in science, but also in chemistry and material science? You were, especially material science, you were really a pioneer.
I was interested in science from a fairly early age in my studies. Mm-hmm. I'm not really sure exactly what turned me on. I was good at it, I guess. That's part of the usually how it works. And I, by the time I was in high school, I had seemed to have selected chemistry as the area that I liked. And I think at that time I was really kind of leaning towards, you know, biochemistry mm-hmm. and biological applications and medicine. It's always very appealing for students. I then went on to my PhD and did chemistry, although I drifted away. I went more into the physical chemistry aspect. But the decision to go into material science was rather not something I chose with time. It was an opportunity that arose when I finished my doctorate and I applied for jobs. And I had several options. And one that came up was something I had not really considered doing too much previously, but it was to go to join AT&T Bell Labs, mm-hmm. which is a research lab, industrial research lab, which is quite known. And I was going to be doing materials development there, sort of change shift gears and do materials development. And I found that exciting. I found it good to change, and it seemed like a big challenge. So I did it, and I've stayed in materials development since then. Mm-hmm. So the take-home is, one of the take-homes is, you know, don't be afraid to go after opportunities that you hadn't really planned, mm-hmm. Because they may be a good decision that you make in your career.
Mm-hmm. I'm guessing when you were starting out, there weren't a lot of women in leadership positions.
In material science or in any position.
Yeah. I mean, I want to ask about the specific challenges you faced, but also this idea of not seeing someone who looked like you in that field. What was that like, and how did you kind of move past it, if you did?
So you know, when you mentioned the big challenge, I mean the big surprise when I began working in Bell Labs doing this kind of work was that I was, if not the only one mm-hmm. of very, very few mm-hmm. women and Hispanics. Mm-hmm. I mean, on both counts, it was a minority. So I was the only woman in my very large 200 or so people unit that mm-hmm. was doing this development work that I was doing. And, you know, it was a little bit sometimes awkward and intimidating, mostly surprising. But fortunately, I was surrounded by a group of people, mostly men, who were very supportive on the whole. So I don't feel like I felt that I had, was victimized or in any way mistreated. In fact, I received good mentoring and good support. Mm-hmm. But there were things that made it, that there were detractions. For example, you have to go to conferences and you have to present your work and you have to network and you're supposed to meet people and talk to them. And then there the atmosphere was much less welcoming, and that was really disappointing and difficult. And, you know, I just had to focus and develop a little bit of a thick skin and go forward. And it's changing. It's changed quite a bit. I was just at the American Physical Society meeting, March meeting, which is this huge meeting. Mm-hmm. And physics is traditionally very, has trouble with women representation. And mm-hmm. it's changed dramatically. I mean, I could see lots of young women participating in the meeting, having a good time. I mean, things that I did not experience in the early days. Mm-hmm. But you get over it, I guess, and you try to find the right people to connect with. And
yeah. I'm going to ask maybe a delicate question, but it's the question of the moment. You're deeply involved in a program that's designed to diversify the field, bring more women in, at a time when the winds of change are blowing against that. Mm. And, it's something that we think about institutionally all the time at City College. But I wonder, as a scientist, how do you, and I'm not asking, what's going to happen to your grant or any of that. I'm asking, as an intellectual leader and a role model in the field, how do you face up to those countercurrents?
I definitely think that the scientific community needs to continue to pursue and focus on diversity and inclusion as essential goals in the sciences. I think if we believe what science has shown, that a more diverse and inclusive environment and ideas lead to better results mm-hmm. in any activity, and including in the sciences, mm-hmm. we must do it. There's just no way of saying, oh, we're going to put it on hold for now.
Yeah.
Now, you know, that being said, so we can't give up the goal. So maybe there are some things we can try to strive for, and in particular, you know, for example, trying to make it clear that striving for diversity does not imply favoritism or unfair practices to others, that it's welcoming for everyone.
Or lowering standards, which is in some ways the most insidious.
Right. So clearing up and trying to teach or, you know, communicate these things so that it's mm-hmm. clear is the only way to go forward until hopefully things, you know, become more
better.
Better.
I think is the
more,
word.
More well, yes, yeah. Just better, yes.
You know, there's a kind of assumption at the core of a lot of this conversation about what's wrong. I'm doing air quotes, by the way, for those of you at home, with diversifying professions, that if you attempt to diversify by bringing new people in, it must happen at the expense of other people. Mm-hmm. And what's beautiful, I think, about the role of women and people of color in science is what you're actually doing is you're adding creative energy to the endeavor. And there's no way to think about that as zero sum. I think the work, let's talk a little bit about that. The work that you do is so collaborative. I mean, even when you talked about quantum computing, you have a part of it.
Right.
But the whole
right.
thing requires all these other people. How is the kind of collaboration at the core of the scientific endeavor benefited by the other work that you do in mentoring and diversifying the profession? Can you?
I mean, mentoring has become something really crucial in this whole endeavor, and I think so mentoring as a factor for career success was really not considered so much way back when I began, when I was studying and when I started my career. They taught us our academic discipline need things that we needed to know, and then they threw us there, and or we were thrown in the to sink or swim and do what you can. And clearly there were mentors, there are people who wanted to be mentors, and I found some of those in the way, but they did it because that was their calling. It wasn't required or needed. Now we have become aware of how important it is to put that in the mix if we really, you know, want to be inclusive and welcoming, because there are other things that people need to address when they are embarking on a career. And I think the results are good. More people succeed in a mentoring and nurturing environment. Mm-hmm. So I'm not sure I'm answering your question exactly, but I think it's you know, it's an essential part, and it's a good development in STEM, and in STEM especially. I mean, these things are all true in all ways of life, but because STEM suffers from a lack of some type of diversity, then I think we really need to make sure it happens.
Yeah, I'm always struck when I see a scientist present research that you always have a slide that in the social sciences, I'm a political scientist, we don't have, which is a picture of all the people that have worked. And it's sometimes 30 and 40 people in these pictures. It's wonderful. Can we talk just for a minute about the specific work that you're doing in IDEALS and the way that you augment the scientific education of the young people that work with you, with all the kind of professional development leadership? And how do you think about that? What do you think are the most important aspects of it?
So, we want to provide the students with extra things that will help them navigate the professional world. Leadership is obviously a very interesting one, because people might think that, you know, leadership skills are for people who want to be the boss or want to be the one who's in charge. And I don't think that's true. I think leadership means, in a more broad general way, means learning to think independently, pursue your goals with, you know, knowing why and in the way persuade others that maybe, you know, what your ideas are good and that they should listen to what you're saying. Mm-hmm. And so these traits are essential, or are not as maybe essential, but certainly very, very favorable and good for anyone in any career, in any profession. Mm-hmm. And so we have leadership skills. We have training in, you know, preparation for job, more practical ones, preparation for job hunting, how to, interview, how to connect with people, how to, and of course, going out and giving talks and conferences, but that's always been done. Entrepreneurship is a more, I think I see it as a more practical skill that scientists really should know about, and not everyone is an entrepreneur. Not everyone wants to do their own business, but for people who do, and science lends itself because you're developing products that will be out in the market. It opens doors for job opportunities that you wouldn't have if you didn't know how to do it. And so we are trying to really incorporate that strongly.
Do you think that entrepreneurial and the commercialization side is a little more, it's a little more proximate in the fabrication of low dimensional systems because of all the emphasis on chips development and all
that?
There
is a lot of activity going on. There's absolutely a lot, and there's a lot of opportunity for doing things in different ways. And there is a big boom, and one has to be careful. There have been other times in the photonics time with the lasers where there was a big boom in entrepreneurship, and then there was a kind of a lull in the. But I think right now there is a very important place for people with ideas and the charge and the know-how to make it happen, and there's a lot of potential.
Yeah. If we take a step outside of the kind of the lab setting, and we start to think about institutions, either at the college level, university level, or the profession, what should we be doing that we're not currently doing to expand inclusiveness and really invest in the success of young scientists like the ones you work with?
Okay, so to answer that question, let me think a little bit. So Mike, I've been at City College for 30 years. The first 20 years or so, I was focused on my research and my career and making sure I led I went as far as I could with my technical work. Of course, I was interested in inclusion and diversity because of who I am and because of where I am at City College. I mean, you can't not think about it.
Right.
And it was a great thing, but it was secondary. Now, since I became involved with IDEALS, but maybe a little bit before that, I've shifted my priorities. And I think these other societal issues are really important, and I would like to have an impact there. And I think what I would say is that institutions have to look back, and that's something we're trying to do a little bit within IDEALS, and look at what the root cause is for the lack of inclusion and the lack of diversity. And instead of just fixing it by let's bring more people, let's bring more students, for example, we're trying to increase the number of students. It doesn't work very well to enhance diversity among the students if the faculty ranks are not diverse.
Right.
Or if the application pool is very small and not diverse. Mm-hmm. So go to those, go to look for those areas that are not being perhaps looked at as closely and really try to make a difference there. Mm-hmm. That would be my quick one piece of advice to how to go about this.
Okay, good.
I'm sure there are many others.
Well, I mean, it's got to be the theme of our work for years, right?
Just
to keep expanding. Now joining our conversation is Ms. Keisha Ruffin. She's the founder and the CEO of Science in the City Incorporated. That's a New York City-based organization that aims to disrupt intergenerational poverty through STEM education and workforce development. Science in the City strives to promote science education and engagement through events, workshops, and educational programs that make science more accessible and engaging. One of the most important events Keisha is involved in is the Life Science Day, which is sponsored by the New York Economic Development Corporation in collaboration with Life Science Cares. The event connects students to opportunities in biotech, life sciences, STEM pathways, and her work integrates technology into educational initiatives to prepare students for emerging roles in biotech, biopharma, and life sciences. By leveraging tools like generative AI and digital platforms, she ensures students gain the skills needed to thrive in a tech-driven future. With nearly 20 years of experience as an educator in underserved communities, powered, I should say, by City College Education, Keisha has dedicated her career to empowering students through equitable access to quality education and resources. She believes technology can bridge socioeconomic gaps and emphasize the importance of holding it to ethical standards. Keisha has developed a 12-week leadership program called Society Ambassadors. Sci City Ambassadors. You know, it's so funny, I saw that on the script, Sci City. I kept correcting. I thought, it's autocorrect. Sci City Ambassadors, Science in the City Ambassadors, which advances workforce development by blending tech and civic training. She holds a master's in special education from the City College of New York and a master's in educational leadership from Fordham University. Keisha, welcome to From City to the World. We're really glad to have you.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So, science in the city has a bold mission to break cycles of poverty through STEM. So what inspired you to start this education or this organization?
I was a frustrated science teacher. Mm. I grew up in East Harlem, and when I became a career changer, and when I started teaching in East Harlem, in the neighborhood I grew up in, I was really disappointed to see the access of science and opportunities that students had in the community. And it really hurt me because I felt like it was so substandard that they weren't even getting what I had received like 10, 12 years prior in like middle school. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. So I just felt like I do something. Yeah. Like, don't just complain.
Yeah, do something.
Start really small and figure it out and gather students and let's do something.
So you've been doing this work for a while now, and mm-hmm. Good to hear about the origins of the organization, but sometimes the mission of an organization comes alive when someone's able to talk about a success story. Do you have one or two sort of favorite stories of somebody that benefited from their engagement with Science in the City?
Yeah, I actually have a student who's here at City
at
College.
At City College.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
So Science in the City has evolved. And it was really after the pandemic when I had a kind of a come to Jesus moment of what do I really want to do? How do I really want to impact the world? And I linked up with Life Science Cares, which is a great nonprofit organization that mission is to eradicate poverty. And in that space, we had Life Science Day. We brought it together. And from there, I had students who I said, well, what do you want to do? And they said, well, we definitely want to like work in medicine. We want to work in bio. And I have two students here that are going to City College that are doing well. Mm-hmm. I have a student, actually three. I have a student who didn't even see himself in college. And it was after going to Life Sciences Day that he saw himself even being a college student. Mm-hmm. Because Science in the City doesn't attract just necessarily the typical student who's already interested in science, mm-hmm. and, you know, they have this trajectory or this idea. It's kind of like take kids who are curious.
Yeah.
Expose them.
Yeah.
And let's see what happens after that. Mm-hmm. And so I even have a student who is a junior in high school now, but after attending Life Sciences Day, he said, you know, I thought I wanted to be a doctor, but now I want to go into biotech. Huh. And it was just because of the exposure of being able to go to a biotech biotech company and mm-hmm. seeing what's being done and then saying, oh, I think I could do this.
Yeah.
So just, I think there's so many. I have students who are now in their 30s. I'm like, you're in your 30s? How are you in your 30s? Like, but I have students who have graduated and have come back to me and said, you know, it was you taking me out into the garden and showing me that there's engineering and gardening. Mm-hmm. That really sparked my interest of where I'm going and what I'm doing now. So mm-hmm. a lot of stories and more to come. I have students all over in different universities that are doing great things.
That's wonderful. I'm going to ask you in a second about the importance of events like Life Science Day. Mm-hmm. But before we get into that, tell me, like, if I went to Life Science Day, what would I see? Like, what is it? How do you set it up? What does it look like?
So that's a great question, and we're actually planning the next one for this year right now. So what you would see, depending on where you go, biotech companies open up their doors and create extensive programming.
So it's all over the city?
All over the city. Uh-huh. It started with one, but I will say at a very nice biotech incubator Cure, which is in Park Avenue South.
Very nice.
The campus is great. It's supported by Deerfield. And that's where the first one. And it was so successful that the New York Economic Corporation said, let's expand this. And so last year we had six biotech companies. And I mean, we even had Tasty, which is in Harlem. It's literally, you can walk there from this campus.
126th Street.
Yes, 126th Street. And these kids live in these neighborhoods, and you would never know that these places exist.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you were to go to Life Sciences Day, you would have programming in a biotech company. You would get to meet scientists, but also just professionals in the field. You would have workshops, which are actually hands-on. You would even have some mini training, which we talk about being a professional and how you need to start to think about how you need to present yourself in the world, even talking about social media. And then also able to connect and reconnect with the adults and professionals at the space. And so they have me, but they also have this access to this network where it continues.
And what's the youngest student that would be involved in this?
So they would be 14 because it's high school.
Okay.
So it's creating a pipeline literally from high school to the life science ecosystem. Having them have ideas about where they want to go early on so that they can strive for it. And it doesn't stop after high school because there's even access to internships.
And do you do work with children that are younger than that? Or is that
I
not
do.
You do?
No, I do. And it's so funny. I have a 12-year-old, and it's really interesting. I work with younger middle school students, and it might start to get even younger. I even do even younger workshops when it comes to the gardening curriculum. But it was because parents would come to me and say, this is so great. This is so great. You know, what else can you do? You're doing things for young kids. And I actually have been doing a action research project with my daughter and friends for the last 3 years and watched them go from elementary school through middle school. So it's a junior SciCity ambassador program. And they go with me anywhere I go to not Life Sciences Day, but anything I do in the city. I have a relationship with Randall's Island where I work with them four times a year. They're there tabling, talking to the public. And it's just amazing to see girls who are like 8 and 9 years old, and they're about to be 13, and see how they've bloomed and blossomed by being able to have access to experiences like that.
Okay, so I'm going to say something to you and to anyone who might be listening, because this, you just rang a little bell in my head. We have community gardens on this campus. And this happens every year. Everybody's on campus in May. Some people are around in June when you plant the crops. But then over the course of the summer, the campus empties out. So I'm saying to you or anyone who's listening, if you're working with children, which is what we always thought the attraction to this community garden would be, and you want to give them a site to work on plants, harvest plants, learn the connection between growing food and eating food, City College has a site where we would work with you on that. So both for you and for anyone listening. But now let me take a step back from Life Science Day and ask you, why are these kinds of events important? Like, what impact does it make on the people that go there?
Well, you know, it's so important because if you don't know, you don't know.
Right.
And so it's the exposure. It's the seed that just planted into the minds of young people where they see a possibility of a world for them that's beyond what's traditionally told to them. It's them coming back home and talking about what they've experienced and knowing that this exists in their backyard. That's what's so important about it. You need to expose young people so they can make a decision or just develop more of their curiosity.
I'm going to ask you something that you maybe weren't prepared to answer, but it jumps off the page. Because your part of your mission is, you know, putting a stop to intergenerational poverty.
That's right.
So do you see the knowledge that these young people are acquiring as they work with you kind of go in the other direction, sort of filtering up? Are they educating their families as well? How does that work?
So much so.
Yeah.
They not only are they educating their families, they want to bring family members to events, maybe other events that I do.
Yeah.
It might not be Life Science Day, but maybe like community events. And not just that. let's just be clear, these jobs pay well.
Yeah.
And that is the bottom line.
Right.
Like, I want young people to have access to what's out there for them. And not all of the positions that they are interested in require 8-10 years of education.
Mm-hmm.
And they find that out even from the panelists at the events. You have scientists who said, oh, I started in community college, or, oh, I started as a doctor, but then I realized I didn't want to be a doctor, but I loved business.
Mm-hmm.
And so I created a business, and then I sold and I exit. We exit at $1 billion. And, you know, like, they would never meet these people or know these stories,
yeah,
and know that they're attainable if they didn't have this access.
Right.
I just wanted to just interject
quickly.
You had asked me, what can be done? And I was saying, looking at the root cause of the problems. I mean, if this isn't a perfect example, trying to do something really where it matters. It's fabulous. It's really
good. Thank you.
Let's now talk a little bit about, Keisha, one of the things that is innovative in the way you approach this work is you're integrating technology like generative AI.
Mm-hmm.
And could you talk a little bit about how that works and especially how the young people take to it?
Well, young people have taken to it already.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, sometimes we have to catch up and probably catch up and guide.
Mm-hmm.
So there's twofold, because there's training that's done on a level for educators who are really afraid of generative AI. You would be surprised how many educators don't use it or have a misconception of what it can do or be in a classroom. So there's that one aspect where exposing teachers and training them on how to use what's even they have access to for free and all these products. But then there's the part where we use things like Meta's VR, right? Virtual reality, where they can go on field trips, where they can see the International Space Station, or they can see the Great Barrier Reef. And so when I'm talking about experiences I've had as an educator, I worked and did some work at the Glenn Space Research Station in Cleveland, Ohio, at NASA, with a bunch of teachers, and I'm talking about my experience. They can go on their VR and, like, see what I'm talking about.
Mm.
Or when I went to Cayman Islands and I got a fellowship to do some work about there was work on lionfish, which are invasive species in the Caymans. And I got to work with teachers and do that work. They can visualize it. They see a representation that looks like them that have done this stuff. But then they also get to travel and envision. And, you know, that really deepens their curiosity and their desire to want to do these things.
Mm-hmm.
And so I meet students where they are. Like, let's go with games. Let's try gamification to, like, have them understand it. Let's even go into something as simple as Amazon, where they have AR. When you go to Amazon and you want to see how something looks in your room, that's AR. That's augmented reality, where you can put an image inside your room and see how it would fit. And I just show them how it's already being done in everyday use, and let's take it to the next level to expose science ideas.
Mm-hmm. So what's so exciting about the way you talk about this work is you talk about it as if, like, the barriers are just being knocked down. You know, AI, augmented reality brings it all right to the children. But we know the barriers still exist.
Yeah.
And so can we talk a little bit about what is still out there that is standing in the way?
Well, mindset is a big barrier that people don't talk about. We already know money, funding is so important to put funding behind these ideas. These things don't happen just because we want them to. We have to actually fight for it and actually demand it. And also, the reason why I say mindset is a big barrier, which you wouldn't maybe think I would say, is because we first have to teach the young people that education is an entitlement. It is not something that, you know, is something they need to ask for, or, you know, if they're special, they'll get this type.
Mm-hmm.
It's like you are entitled to see the world and to learn about things and to believe that you can be more than your surroundings.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's one of the biggest barriers, is shifting the mindset so that people could want to fight for things or want more. instead of being told this is your space and like stay in your space. I've noticed that when you expose young people, they start to think differently. They bring that back home. They start to say, hey, let's do this. You know, let's go here, mom. Or, oh, I heard this was happening. Can you take me here? Mm-hmm. And it changes even the experiences that the family has. Mm-hmm. And that's really important. So I would say first a mindset. And then I would say, of course, funding can be a huge barrier because we need the funding for projects like this. We just do.
Who supports the work that you do? Is it, I mean, do you get these same biotech companies that open their doors? Are they vigorous supporters of this work?
That is an interesting.
Not asking you to tell any trade secrets.
No, actually. I mean, the biggest supporter right now is my partnership with Life Science Cares and the New York Economic Corporation. That's the most. They are the vigorous supporters, and they see the vision. So much so that the first year, because this part is relatively new, the first year was one, second year was six. Now we're talking 10. Mm-hmm. And we're talking 10, not just in Manhattan. Now it's the Bronx, Jersey, Manhattan. Mm-hmm. And so we definitely still need to do a lot of work to kind of get the word out and get the support there because we know it's there. And sometimes things just need to be funneled or need to be cleared and so that they can see the definite impact that it's having on young people and on the community as a whole. But I'm confident. Yeah. I'm confident.
So let me tell you, this was not an idle question. Ladies and gentlemen out there listening, I want to give Keisha an opportunity to, if someone is listening to this and thinks, this is something I really want to support, how do they get in touch with you?
Oh, that is great.
Come on now.
you can go to my website. That's like the best way to reach out to me. And there's a connect. It's www.scicity, which is scicityco.com. And it has it shows pictures, images of everything we're doing. There's a contact, there's an info. There's even for SciCity ambassadors out there who are not yet SciCity ambassadors. If you're interested and you're a young person, you can go on the website and find out how you can join in on the next things that we have going on. And no, thank you for that opportunity because, we need all of it.
So if you didn't have your pen when she said that, I'm going to give her an opportunity at the very end of the show to repeat that website. But I'm not done with you yet.
Okay.
I want to talk a little bit about your SciCity ambassadors and your blending. I mean, in the same way that Dr. Tamargo's program blends sort of some of the commercialization and leadership training with the science, you're doing the same, but you're blending it with civic education. And could you tell me how you think about those two things?
Well, so much of what I do comes from my own experience. And I might be dating myself now, but, when I was at the dinner table and I was younger, we always had conversations about what was going on in the world. So much so, I remember being, I think I was 10, and I remember saying that I was not going to wear Reeboks, which was really popular in the 80s, because they needed to divest from South Africa. And I just remember saying stuff like that at such a young age because we talked about what was going on and how we can't just live in a space where we don't think about the world and people around the world. And I think that when you teach young people how to engage civically, it makes them more critical thinkers. They are able to solve complex problems. They can see the world, how diverse it is, and see different perspectives. And it just makes a better workplace. I think it's so important to show young people that they have power. Like, I couldn't vote at 10, but I still felt like at 10, I could do something. Yeah. And I felt really powerful about that. And we get our young people to find out, like, who are your council people? Who are your assembly people? Who are we calling in Congress? Like, who are our senators? Like, we need to know who these people are so that when you're ready and you're voting, you already have this education.
Yeah. I before I took this job, I used to teach political science here at City College, and the number of articles about the role of scientific communities in the advancement of things like nuclear disarmament or environmental protection, things that politicians can't necessarily do, scientists develop a consensus and then are able to bring that into the political sphere. So I love this idea that civic education goes hand in hand with scientific education. Last question for you. If I'm a young person listening to this and I'm like, not really sure this is for me, what would you say to a young person who's not sure that it's time to jump in and get involved in science in the city?
I'd say I love that you're even thinking about what's for you and what's not for you, because that means that you're on the right track already. I would say come out into some of our events. They're not all Life Sciences Day. Sometimes we do work with, like I said, Randall's Island, where we do community events and we have people come out. We even have SciCity ambassadors help table and interact with the community. We do things where we were working with a school in Senegal and we were fundraising so that they could have classes in the summer and have materials to do their, actually they were doing quantum physics. They were actually doing that and they needed materials and just basic stuff. And we were actually fundraising for food because they had a scientist working with them, but they didn't have a space to go to, didn't have any money for food, so we were fundraising so they would have lunch every day. And then just say, you know what, it's so much bigger than just being in the world of STEM. Is bigger than just being a scientist or thinking of being a doctor. It's really being a citizen. And they could find pathways to those spaces, whatever they're interested in.
Okay, all right. Well, listen, folks, here's what we've done today. We started out talking about some of the pioneering years that Dr. Tamarco had, when there weren't so many women involved in STEM, and moved it to where we're at right now, with programs like the IDEALS program at City College and Science in the City, but always kind of thinking about what's next, not just for the scientific pathways, but also for the effort to bring more women, more people of color, people from diverse backgrounds into the science field. And so I think, Keisha, where we ended, with young people kind of thinking about where they want to be, this is for everybody. And we're not going back to where we were back when you were at Bell Labs, but we still have a lot of work to do to make sure that anyone with interest and drive and curiosity can find a place in a STEM field. And that's got to be a birthright. So, Keisha, I'm going to give you one more chance. Ladies and gentlemen, I hope you got your pens and your pencils out there. What's the website that they should
get? The website is www.scicity, which is SCICITYCO.com. And I would really love if you just go on the website, see what we have going on. And if you want to support. And if you want to get involved. We have opportunities for people to get involved in community events as well. Mm-hmm. And maybe even the garden at City College.
There you go. And Dr. Tamarco, if someone is thinking about going to college or going to graduate school or maybe being involved in IDEALS, what would you say to them as a kind of Women's History Month capper here?
Oh, by all means, go for it. Come also visit our website and come to the Graduate Center website and look at opportunities here. I do want to give my website for the center. It's www.idealscrest.org.
Okay, fantastic.
Thank you.
Thank you to both of you. This has been such a good conversation. To the audience, I want to say thank you for listening through From City to the World. Special thanks once again to our guest, Professor Maria Tamarco, who is the director of the National Science Foundation CREST Center, IDEALS, and she is a City College alum. Oh, and also City College alum Keisha Ruffin, who is the founder and CEO of Science in the City. This show was produced by yours truly, Vince Boudreau. Also by Kazia Sullivan. Thanks, everybody.